We are now moving into our A Public Affair Hour. And in studio, I have Kim Mooney. She'll be doing her quarterly program on death and dying. Her program is called Practically Dying. And she has a guest here as well, Thad Fry. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. Good
morning. Start us off. What do you have in store for us today? We're going to be talking about four main topics.
We're going to be talking about grief, one of the least popular topics in the world, next to death. And people always think that they are only intrinsically related, but there's a lot more to it. And the reason, and first, let me just say, we've been doing the show for 10 years. I say this regularly because it's really important. Things like grief, nobody wants to talk about. KGNU made a commitment 10 years ago that these topics were important enough that they would become part of their regular programming. And this is hugely significant because the teaching that we've had in the last 10 years and the things I've gotten from the people in the community, this has been invaluable. Light touch, really well, highly respected source. So you have created a learning format in this community that's critical. I want to thank you for that.
Oh, happy to have it.
Okay, so talking about grief, the first and most important thing, we're going to cover the nature of grief, the process of grief, the different kinds of grief, and then how do we do this? How do we do it wrong and how do we do it right? And the reason it's the most important thing in our lives in some way is it's a birthright. It's one of the things that we all come in with. It's one of the things we're all going to deal with our entire lives until the final grief, which is when we die. So the nature of grief is much bigger than we think of, and we live with it all the time. What we tend to do is we tend to think about this, we carve out the acute piece of grief, which is after a significant loss, when you're devastated, when your world has fallen apart, and we don't really pay attention to how we live with it our whole lives because we do that, or the other pieces of it. Grief can contain moments of wonder and joy and gratitude and appreciation, as well as what we think of most of the time is that it's a bummer of an emotional state. And for a lot of people, it's not highly emotional. There are people who grieve a lot somatically. You know, the man who will say, I'm not having any trouble since my wife died, but he's grinding his teeth into, you know, he's going to the dentist. So to recognize what the nature of it is not only helpful because we need to be respectful of it, but in this culture, if you don't know what's going on, it's going to fall into some other pocket. So we see a lot of people who are in deep grief who are being medicated or who are being, we'll talk about disenfranchised grief later, who are being told that this isn't that big a deal. So it's really critical to understand and name what it is. And as soon as you call it grief, it may look like something else, but it's natural. It's nothing wrong with it. It's just really hard. And the other piece is to understand that this is a personal experience and a human experience, and they are completely tied up in each other. So the other piece about grief that we know is that you can't do it yourself. Whether your community consists of one other person or recognizing the wholeness, George Floyd, you know, Princess Diana dies and the world goes to pieces for reasons because it's the grief of being human, not just personal grief.
I just want to say thank you for having us. I'm a therapist here in Boulder, Colorado. Have my own loss history, like many of the people that I'm sure are listening to us right now. Thad Fry. And I just wanted to say thank you for KGNU for having us and Kim for hosting this on a quarterly basis. And what I heard as we're kind of setting up this framework is that we're really wanting to normalize this process. We want grief not to be a scary word, not to be something that hopefully we can avoid throughout our lives, because we can't. It is a birthright. It is part of our process. So hopefully while we talk over this next hour and we give examples and stories, people that are listening right now can hear them about themselves or parts of themselves or family members, and can hear that and again be able to normalize it for themselves and for their community. And I wanted to also speak to what you just finished off there, that it is a very individual thing, and we try to make sure that people understand we're going to grieve differently within family systems and within our community. But that's also a Western way of thinking, that it's about the independent individual, right? We also are very much, as Kim said, I like that she mentioned, it can be one other person in community, or it can be a larger community. It can be our church community. It can be whatever we're involved in. But to be able to speak to grief in this way is wonderful. So thank you again for having me.
Mm-hmm. So I want to break that down a little bit because I think it's important when we say it's lifelong. When you talk to people about grief, immediately they go, oh, no, it's so depressing and I'm not going to live my life paying attention to it because I don't want to be down all the time. But when you recognize that we all are going to suffer from it, you know, an acute grief, really part of the nature of it is not knowing what's happening. Really being disintegrated. That's what we use some of the languages. We consider ourselves integrated human beings, and yet this disintegrates us. We can't think the same way. Our bodies aren't the same way. We get really exhausted. We think we're going crazy. There's actually been studies done about going crazy. So the more we understand the nature of this, so when I say it's lifelong, yeah, we get stronger as we grow along. We don't realize that, you know, losing our pet when we're six sets the tone for how we're going to think about grief for our whole life. But it is a first loss that we find out that we live through. So lifelong means that everybody has losses all along the way. And we'll talk a little bit because yes. Now I'm 71. One of the most significant non-death losses in this country is aging. And we don't do it very well. But each loss that we deal with follows us through our lives. It's normal. I think that's the biggest thing what Todd was saying is it's not pathological, but it's really normal to carry that loss. And most of us get better at it. Most of us get better and grow from it. Some people don't. So a kid in one of my grief groups, his dad died when he was about six, and he missed his dad, and they did all of the acute grief work. They had a funeral. They talked about it. They kept moving with it. But when he was 13, very personally, he started to grow hair on his arms, and it was the same color as his dad's. And there was a moment for him alone where he missed his dad at that point. That's what it means to be living with grief. A lot of the times, most of the time we integrate it, but we still move on, and it doesn't mean that it's over. So thinking that you see the back of your mother's head in a crowd 20 years after she dies, and your heart breaks for just a minute. And people who talk about grief a lot will say the grief never gets better. We get stronger muscles around it. You know, I never quit missing my mother, but it doesn't take me down now when I think about her. So as we weave through life, if we think about it as a lifelong natural process, it inherently changes us. And that's another reason it's really important to name it, because it helps us see that we are different human beings because of it. And I'll say one more thing about the nature is that most people grow beautifully through grief. Most of the time it clarifies your belief systems or your values, or it's just being in love with the nature of life. At some point you recognize it. The worst thing I think people can do is talk to someone about how beautiful this will be and how much they'll appreciate this at the wrong time. It's a travesty.
I have a question. Today is International Women's Day, and you were just talking about the death of a mother and never really being able to completely digest it or get over it, in a sense.
Metabolize it.
Yeah, that's the word. Okay. So today is International Women's Day, and I'm just wondering, are there any special mechanisms for helping people to process the grief of losing a family matriarch?
Yes. I'm going to write this down. Let's lay a framework for this. Absolutely.
Yes. I mean, if we're talking about mother loss, we're speaking in generalizations here, but that idea of having a maternal figure in one's life, having somebody who is kind of the rock emotionally. And I was just talking with somebody yesterday that was talking about that. And people use these terms like, this person was the rock in our family. And then I can assume what that means. But then when we go into that, it's always interesting to hear what that is. Because with this person, the rock meant that I knew I could always come to her. I knew that I'd be safe. I knew that I could, you know, the hardest part is I'm grieving her, and she's the person I would go to if I was going through this grief prior. So again, it's helping people break down their verbiage, helping them understand how to be with themselves, and sometimes finding other people to be able to hold certain roles eventually in those ways as well.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's really critical that we talked about before we came in here is that we used to talk about the difference between how men grieve and women grieve. It was about 20 years ago, some of the researchers just went, wait a minute, we have this all wrong. That there are different kinds of grievers on a continuum. There are grievers who we call intuitive, who tend to be more emotional, want to talk about things, process it, and people on the other end who are instrumental, who may want to do something. So they may be the ones that want to get all the phone calls made or build the coffins in the old days. And we tended to break those down into sexes, genders. And what we realize now is everybody swings along this continuum. So the people in the country who are the least likely to get support are women who are not highly emotional. But we've known for a long time that men who cry are not considered normal. So now we have this better understanding of how we grieve and what we grieve. And this has been really helpful with the queer community. It's been really helpful for everybody to just have more permission to grieve. That said, there are historical griefs that we would say are women's griefs. And some of them, when you're talking about losing a matriarch, I think I would broaden that and say for our community in general, the losses of the female, traditional female roles, or the losses of the parts that we've considered to be more mother than father, like holding the heart. So for example, in the 1800s, baby mortality rate was like 45%. There were no antibiotics. Between the age of 1 and 5, they would die of everything. If you look at the tombstones there, they didn't even name them. They would say baby young. They wouldn't name them for 6 months or so because they weren't sure if they were going to survive. In that cultural context, even though the grief was as deep for losing a child, it was expected. So it was held in a different way, but it was held. Today, when we have a loss like that, the expectation, our assumptive world, is that we'll have a baby, that the birth rates will stay very high. So when you're talking about losing something like a matriarch, what we're looking at is not just the individual loss of that rock, but we're looking at how that sits in a cultural context. Like we have an idea that, and we talk about it, that in Black families, the grandmother often in this country takes over, and runs the family system. And some of that comes from the necessity right now. Some of it comes from an old matriarchal piece. You don't diss the grandma, Yep. The grandma knows a lot. So whether or not we recognize and hold that, we miss it. And what we're trying to do is get back to the fact, what you were saying, is that we recognize the roles that that person had and then be able to either give them to someone else, pass them down as a legacy, which has not happened with us. We have not allowed the matriarchal lineage to hold cultural power, although it does. So another piece we want to talk about is what happens when we don't recognize what's happening? What do we do? How does it get subverted? What happens to women who are not allowed to have the power they have? And historically, we've seen that a lot. We've seen what happens when, where to go with this? Because there's so much about matriarchy.
I wanted to say, one of the things about grandmothers, a lot of times they have the power to, in Spanish it's called convocar, it's like to gather all of the various family members. So for example, if you come from a large family, or you marry into a large family, you'll see that, sometimes if like the grandma says, it's really important, like it really means a lot for me if you could be here for my 80th birthday, mm-hmm. or if you could be here for Christmas, and it's like, we're going to have to go because grandma asked for it, mm-hmm. right? So one of the spaces that grandmothers have is the ability to tie together all of the cousins, for example. So, marrying into a large family, I would see that, it's like the where you would see the largest gatherings are specifically when the grandmother says, I want you here mm-hmm. on this date at my house. And it's like all the cousins are there. Mm-hmm. And even the ones who don't like live in the state, so grandmothers kind of have that power to be able to call a meeting, essentially. And I think the largest meeting the last time I went to a meeting that large was, her funeral, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of families do fall apart after the matriarch dies. Culturally, again, to broaden this out, this is what happened to us in this last century. So World War II comes along, right? Rosie the Riveter, we all understand this. The men went away, the women picked up these jobs. They got great value out of it. They learned a lot about themselves. they actually developed many different kinds of power. And then the war was over culturally, and they were told to go back home. Well, they not only had to go back home, which is a huge grief process, to have many of your identities taken away, but this was at a time in our country when the country was changing and we had highway systems and we developed suburbia. What happened then was that the intergenerational family fell apart. And women moved into these homes on their own by themselves. And the next thing you know, early 60s, Valleys of the Doll. Women are on Valium. Women are depressed. They are grieving and no one acknowledges it because externally, they're now living in their own home in the suburb. It all looked good on the outside. But what it did was it destroyed the intergenerational family. And having grandma in the house raising the kids is really different than going away for the holidays and seeing her. And I think that's one of the biggest things. I came in, my age bracket really came in at the in the middle of that when we started recognizing what we didn't have left.
Yeah. So when you both were, both your stories, I wrote down family and ritual. So you both spoke to it beautifully, is that idea that often the matriarch can be the person that brings the family together and also brings the family together to do rituals. So rituals, we might not think about it in that way, but a birthday party can be a ritual. Obviously, funerals are rituals. And just as a side note, we now have celebrations of life. We, because of COVID, we sometimes moved a celebration of life or a funeral to a year later because we had to, right? So all these things that helped us understand who we were as an individual, who we were as a family, who we were as a society, often they're getting watered down. And so when you lose integral parts of the family, you also can potentially, just in Kim's, in your conversation around this, we can disperse and lose those things for our society. And then the next generation might not even understand, oh, you guys used to do that? I didn't even realize that was a part of the thing. That's something I read about in a book, right? We're no longer doing that. So I think that idea of allowing ourselves to understand how grief, as we look at it as an individual thing, really does affect our society at large. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate us having this conversation.
Mm-hmm. There's something, this is going to sound a little minute, but there's something about COVID as a larger, we're talking about it as a cultural grief or international world grief, yeah. Is that, excuse me, in my industry, it actually had a backward blessing, which is people started thinking more about their mortality, sometimes because they had an immediate loss, but it was in the field. We were living in this collective, very loud grief, and they started paying more attention. And so I had one person actually say to me, and I was glad they noticed this, they did have to put off a funeral for a year. On the one hand, it was tragic. On the other hand, it taught her what we've been saying is, oh, a year later, we'd had much more time to think about this and process it. Mm. And the funeral was very different than it would have been if we had to have it 2 weeks afterward, which energetically is one of the problems that we have, is that we're assuming that there will be a loss, we'll have a funeral, it'll be over, and then you move on. So one of those kind of the myths was sort of broken for her. I thought it was really interesting.
I'll just add, might sound like a random side note, but I'll add cremation becoming normalized. That really has changed whether we have a funeral, and it, since everybody is often dispersed in families across different states, if death happens, especially suddenly, everybody had to race back to wherever that person's loss was and have the funeral. Now with cremation, oftentimes we can have it a week later, 2 weeks later, and be able to bring family together in those ways, just as COVID didn't allow us to get together. So there are different ways that with the way that culture is looking at things, that does change the way that we're able to have ritual. And sometimes it has the blessing as well as the difficult side of that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When we talk about funerals, I'm one of the things that is in the U.S., I mean, you say 2 weeks later, a week later, that's a long time for other cultures. Sometimes it's like you can be, if a death happens over a weekend, you know, the burial has already happened mm-hmm. by the time you get back. Like you find out about it after it's already over, right? So what kind of differences have you noted when it comes to processing grief when the funerals are just like, you know, mm-hmm. 3 days later, the person is already in the ground?
Well, you know, again, it's going to be really individual because for us, because we have not had much ritual around, the funeral is a really big deal. For some other cultures, the body, that's an indigenous culture in the tropics. The body has to be disposed of right away, but that doesn't mean that they don't quit grieving collectively. So we market, you know, again, we're very tied into the sort of one image, and the image is acute grief, body disposition, move on. But in places where, you know, they invite the bodies, there are places, I mean, please don't ask me, in the Philippines, I'm thinking of the name, where they keep the bodies close. They keep their ancestors close. And at the end of a year, they bring the bodies back out and they talk to them and they celebrate them and then they send them away again. So their grief process, they have a fuller grief process. The components just look different because they're not locked into one piece that has our cultural problems, which is get it over it, don't understand it, and just get it out of the way. So as that model changes, we might find out that we'll have more and more opportunities along the way to grieve. I mean, we have some really beautiful customs that we're aware of. A year after a Jewish death, there's a ceremony at the graveside stones. I mean, but we don't do that regularly. And so we consider that beautiful, but it's not what most of us expect.
Or in Mexico, you have Day of the Dead. And I lived in Mexico for many years, and I would mention something about Day of the Dead maybe to my U.S. relatives, and they're like, oh, that's so morbid. It's like, no, it's actually really healthy, right? And this mm-hmm. lack of understanding that, you know, being able to have this process of life, which is death, accompany you and be able to know that, you know, it's going to happen to every single person that you love. It's going to happen to you. And here are certain ways that you keep the person's memory alive. Maybe it's you're eating their favorite food right around November 2nd, right? Mm-hmm. So, or you're putting up their favorite flowers on the altar. I think that in U.S. society, it's very compartmentalized, where it's just like, and I'm wondering what kind of, for people that, whose cases you have knowledge of, who compartmentalize that grief in such a way that they're not really kind of confronting it or letting themselves metabolize, as you said, are there any health concerns that you have to be on the lookout for people who do not outwardly process it?
They don't have to outwardly process it, yes, but they do have to process it, and absolutely. You want to start the litany?
sure, but I'll say outward processing would look like mourning, right? So that's the outward expression. Grief is the internal expression. And so beautiful to be able to talk about it in that way. So yeah, again, looking at it somatically, I utilize something that I utilized in hospice for years, which is called scope of grief responses. And I utilized it to look at the mental, physical, emotional, behavioral, and spiritual sides of grief, and have one of the people that I was working at just circle all the things that were coming up for them to be able to look at them while they were in acute grief, and then we might look at it in 3 months later or 6 months later to kind of see that. So some of the physical pieces that we look at are diminishment or increase of appetite. That can be true of sleep. So some people feel bad because they're sleeping all the time. Well, if I'm grieving, I should be on the other side of it. Plenty of people can't fall asleep, or they get woken up in the middle of the night. You're going to have things like that Kim was speaking to previously, that muscle guarding, that being in a fight or flight response, or amygdala. When we think about it, we don't often think of the brain, but we're often in this fight, flight, or freeze response because it is a trauma often. Obviously, a sudden loss is a trauma differently than maybe a long-term loss, but it's a trauma nonetheless, and nobody else gets to judge what our nervous systems feel in that way. So as long as we can kind of normalize it and help people understand the physical sensations that might go on, I think, like you said, for our mainly physical grievers, they get to go, oh, I'm actually grieving. Mm-hmm. And then I often use that same scope of grief responses to educate other people in their family. So sometimes I work with a couple and they've lost a child. So we might have one that's crying all the time and doing things that we think of more traditional, either emotional or physical responses, but I have them look at it and write that up with each other and go over it so that they can better understand who they are. So I know I spoke to a lot of things there, but a lot of, ulcers happen a lot. Definitely, it can become clinical depression. There's a lot of things that can happen physically, mm-hmm. for sure.
So what I like about what you said is, again, the second we wanted to talk about is the process. So recognizing what's normal sometimes just helps people. Oh, God, I'm fine. I'm grinding my teeth. This is not weird. But then watching it as a process, you can tell if something hasn't changed in 8 months. For example, we used to say, and it used to be truer, that if you lost a child, a lot of couples got divorced. Well, they didn't know how to navigate it. They usually were different kinds of grievers. And so they expected the other person to be grieving like them. Divorce rate's gone down a lot since people have started getting therapy or counseling with people who really understand the process. But the issue used to be that if you took your child's room and you shut the door and you never changed it, something was wrong with you. And you weren't moving on, quote unquote. And now we look at, again, the wholeness of their life. Okay, so they haven't changed their child's room. Are they reinvested in their job? Is the rest of their life okay? So we've expanded what we think might be wrong to looking at that individual person. So if someone's doing something that is life-threatening or they're having physical reactions, then you have to break it down and step in. So what do we see with people who absolutely refuse to grieve? First line is, as soon as you can identify it with them, they might unclench. But people who don't deal with it very, very individually may shut down and not be willing to take risks ever again. They do have we see high rates of alcoholism. A really good example is George Floyd. You tell people that they can't grieve, and it can become explosive. So what could be personal grief becomes the hidden cultural grief. You know, epigenetics talks about the grief that is built into us from before. The Holocaust, you know, what are we carrying in ourselves, and do we still carry it? And they find that women who've been exposed to high trauma, their babies might be much more susceptible to loud noises. So we carry this with us generationally. And that's also what I think happens when you're talking about losing a matriarch or someone, is that we have this longing in us that we may not have had from a personal grief. So talking about it and opening up just allows us to respect it and address it in a different way. But we do see at the very, very far end people who kill themselves because they can't adapt to or live with the world without whatever it was. Their health. You know, I know a friend of mine who was an incredible sportsman and very physical and used his body a lot to express himself, very high, and he got ALS. For him, the idea of getting to the point where he couldn't move at all and be paralyzed was so deep that rather than be able to, as some other people did, grieve each stage along the way and decide to stay with it, he very early took his own life. Now, is that wrong? Well, in some circles, that would be considered wrong. In other circles, that would be considered a man taking control over the quality of his life and what he wanted to live with.
I want to stick a pin in that, but first I have to say, because we are at the top of the hour, you are listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver. Something that you just said that I'm also wondering about is, here in Colorado, you have the right to end your life if you have, there are certain circumstances, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, what if you know the date that you're going to die, mm-hmm. how does that create a space mm-hmm. in which other people can, you know, they know about it beforehand, because we were saying that a sudden death can be very traumatic. Is it less traumatic when people say, you know, I've made this decision, this date is going to be the date, I want to do this before I go, and accompany me in the process?
You know, this is perfect. We just opened the endoflifeoptionscolorado.org organization. It's a state organization that's working a lot with medical aid in dying, which is what you're talking about. And so the big issue amongst the opponents is medical aid in dying the same as suicide? Yes, it is. No, it isn't. And with medical aid in dying, there's a very clear process. It's for people who are already terminally ill. And this is one of the things we say. People who want to die by suicide, they don't want to be here. People who use medical aid in dying, they would love to be here, but their bodies are dying already. So you have to have competence or capacity. They make sure that not only do you have to be mentally competent, but because of the way our laws are in this country, you have to be able to self-ingest. Somebody else can't feed you the medicine. And what we want with that is exactly what you're saying. Is it easier? Is it better to know when you're going to die? The whole process of it, being able to have time to say goodbye, knowing that you're not going to be in pain. Many people get this prescription and never take it. They just want to know they're not going to be subject to the medical system, who may very well try to keep them alive because that's their main training. Yay. So what's interesting is that for the most part, I would say the grief is easier because all of the things that you want to get done at the end of your life, which are not medical, they're quality of life, you have the chance to set that up. That specific piece, knowing the exact time you're going to die, people go both ways. Some people are very comforted by it. Family members are very comforted. Afterwards, some people are tortured by it. I didn't want that last 4 hours, or did I, or should I have gotten him to wait another day? It's a completely different kind of conundrum than we deal with most of the time. But it is a very specific point. So for people who set the time, sometimes they say, look, I'm just done, but I want to wait until that game is over on Friday. Uh-huh. You know, or I'm going to my granddaughter's wedding, or no, I just get to the point that one of the unfortunate things about that law, and we can do another show on it at some time, is that people who don't have capacity, like people who have dementia, have to make the decision to use that medicine earlier than they would have because they can't use it if they don't have capacity. So one of the griefs in that is they are giving up some of their lifetime. They have to make a decision. I'm doing this now rather than waiting 2 months because I don't want to become unqualified again.
I want to jump in on this one because I think it's a great subject, and obviously it's localized here in Colorado and a few other states, but it brings up different styles of grief, and one of the ones that we had talked about previously was anticipatory grief, right? So this affords, does not mean that everybody, just as Kim said, some people are going to say this really is helpful, other people are going to say, I don't agree with mom's decision, I'm actually going to not come out, right? I'm not going to fly out and meet with her. You're going to have all sorts of different responses. But with anticipatory grief, we get to start the process. We get to engage with it differently. It isn't a car accident that happens and we had no understanding that this was going to happen. It also allows for, again, I'll go back to that idea of ritual, just because in U.S. society, it's so limited in what our rituals are. Mm-hmm. The more I can talk about it and normalize it, and it can be small little things. Think about doing like a living funeral. What would that be like to be at your own funeral? You know, and to have people talk about how you made meaning in your life with them. I mean, I'm getting choked up just thinking about the idea of being able to have that with people that I love dearly, and what that must be like for somebody who knows that they are going to take medicine and pass, that they've affected their loved ones, and that I, as a loved one or friend or part of their community, have the opportunity to look them in the eyes, hold their hand, mm-hmm. take that time to be able to say, this is who you are and who you will be continue to be, because we continue to have relationships with people after they pass. So I think, again, it does afford us a lot. It doesn't, however, mean that everybody's in agreeance and that it's necessarily easier.
Yes. So. No, the same process. But something you said is really important. The idea of doing ritual, we have prescribed rituals. We have a funeral, a memorial service. We send out cards. Those are big and they're important. But we don't realize that because we need each other to do this, rituals happen all the time in small ways that affect us. As we say, below the threshold of the mind, that's where a lot of it gets done. So driving by a roadside memorial where a kid has died and seeing all those flowers, that's a ritual, and that impacts us even if we didn't know the child. So one of the things that has happened, I have a lot of great stories about medical aid and dying, and I also understand the complexities, but you have to really break it out. But one family, as the father was preparing to take the medication, they went out and had mugs made for everybody that had a picture of the whole family on it. So they all had a drink with him at the same time. They just didn't drink the same thing. It was a beautiful, and they all walked away with a cup, you know, just like we would at another family gathering. There are lots of humor around this, and that's what I mean. Grief isn't all just being morbidly depressed. But I will say that I think that's one of the biggest issues in this country is that we avoid deep emotion. We get pulled into it, and then we're angry that we can't get out of it. And that's often what happens with grief. It decimates your whole life. But if we were better at handling the big emotions, we wouldn't run from them so quickly. So one of the transformative things about grief is that you can't avoid it. And so when you go down into it, whether you come out in a healthy way or not, and most people will, it's unavoidable. And everything else that we can get away with, 5, you know, like 2-minute spots, how many ways do we medicate ourselves? And what are the huge, I'm going to go back to aging, you know, aging is a huge grief process. Physically, it's hard to not be able to do the things you used to. It's really hard to be in. But the wrinkle piece is a multi-million dollar business trying to avoid the grief of aging. And they've done a pretty successful job at it.
So I have another localized question. I mean, here in Boulder, the baby boomers make up the largest part of the population. And I would say, but we know due to listener surveys that the largest demographic that listens to KGNU is over 65 years of age. What special programs exist? Because you can see in Boulder, there's the, you know, the Age Well Center and the plenty of retirement communities. What kinds of programs exist in these centers to prepare people for these kinds of discussions as they have a much higher rate than normal of their social, of their peer group dying?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's lots of different ways, entry points into talking about death. And unfortunately, what a lot of people do, because I've been doing this 30 years and I know some really good tricks. One of the things that we do, unfortunately, is we sit you down and say, Shannon, let's talk about your death. Not a good entry point. So what we see for a lot of audiences, specifically in Boulder, I think are really interesting programs on death around the world, the concept of mortality, you know, and then you can take one step closer. I've got a workshop that I'm actually doing is like six steps to getting to where you're comfortable with death. And so another one is talking practically about the things you need practically. Somebody may say, I don't want to talk about death. But when you say to them, okay, well, then I'm assuming that if you were in a coma, your family would all agree on what to do. Well, no, not really. Okay, well, I'm assuming that you would trust a doctor to make the same choices. So you can back them in, because boomers particularly, we want control. So going into starting to talk about death, about the practical pieces rather than the emotional piece of losing your life and your body and everything you care about, those are really skillful ways. Well, we still spend tons of time trying to set up advanced directives workshops. You know, what does it mean to choose someone to take care of you if you can't speak for yourself? April, I think it's 16th coming up, is National Healthcare Decision Day. So you will see these advanced care workshops all over. So I think what has to happen, I think people go into the mechanics more. The farther away the introduction can be is probably the best way to do it. But we also have a very sophisticated audience in Boulder County, so they're willing to contemplate things. You'll see in some of the senior centers, just let's talk about mortality in general, you know, because the secret is, if you're willing to pay attention to your mortality, you're going to live a better life every single day. This idea that we're endless is probably the thing that makes us so clumsy and awkward and careless. So yeah, Boulder County is pretty open to a lot of different things. And if you look at the elder communities, I mean, when I get in the elevator at Fraser, there's always at least one or two in there like, hey, kids, let's pay attention in an interesting way.
No, Fraser's an interesting place. I mean, and I think that there's also, you know, in that particular community, you have a lot of people who were highly engaged in their younger years. And they remain engaged. Like, you talk to people there and they're like, yeah, now that I'm retired, I have all this extra time to like pursue my passions. Yeah.
I would add that this is more individual, because I'm an individual private practitioner. But Boulder County is also, again, generalizing here, but willing to go to therapy, willing to do counseling, willing to do their own personal work. And so that can be with a coach, it could be with a spiritual advisor. And I think having, like you said, folks that are 65 and older, having those conversations, death and dying is going to be a part of those conversations. Grief is going to show up. If we're doing any of our individual work, we might be talking about grief of another person. But if somebody says, you know, tell me about your mother and tell me about, you know, what she instilled in you, what do you still have? What do you relay about her to your own kids or to your community? Mm-hmm. And then it's easy enough to also say, okay, how do you want to be remembered? Mm-hmm. And then be able to, it's an unfolding. It doesn't have to be a big, scary thing. Tell me about death, right? This is more about, let's talk about life and death being one hand in one the other. And let's talk about it in that way. And I think most people can start to meet that. Mm-hmm. And if they can't, then professional help or community help. Again, the more we're doing exactly what we're doing in this room, the better. So, again, thank you.
And that, what you just said, and we've talked about this before, one of the ways in is stories. And you will see with a lot of the people in Boulder County, even in the senior centers, going into workshops that are about exactly this. Write about your life story. Tell me about your grandmother. You know, it's very, that's probably the most comforting way in because it's colorful and it's not didactic. And, yes. You know, families of, when we, the first time after my, two of my grandparents died, we bought a big, beautiful candle and we just put it in the middle of the table at Christmas. Said, let's talk about grandma. For the first 5 minutes, nothing. And then somebody said, remember when she used to take her teeth out and try to scare you? And so we never said she's dead, but now that candle is about an inch tall. And every holiday, we bring it out. The family's considerably smaller now after grandma died. But we bring it out and we just tell stories. And it is. It's the acknowledgement. Yeah, they're gone and we still hurt. And there's life. And then we eat.
Yes, and then we eat. I love that. And one of the things that I've utilized with people, if they celebrate Christmas or any other holiday around, it doesn't necessarily have to be around that time, but often as a community where people will be grieving, but think that this is supposed to be a happy time of year, right? So this one I love, where somebody can set, you can wrap a present and make it look really nice and put a hole in it and keep a notebook next to that present. And what I tell people is that when you think about your loved one who just passed, your grandmother that passed, and sit down and write a story about them, one of what, you know, what you remember, what they made for you, how they showed up for you, write that down and put that into the present. So you slide that piece of paper, and then on Christmas or whatever special holiday or special time, birthdays, I have people, then you can open the box and as a family you can read those different stories. And it's beautiful not only to hear your own story and being out loud and looking people in the eyes as we're doing right now, but also sometimes we forget about our loved ones, that they affected other people in certain ways. Oh, I forgot about that story. They did that. I didn't remember that. So we get to re-engage with that person that we lost in this beautiful way. That's happened in my own personal life. So again, that's one little thing that we can do that can make large effect, normalize, tell the stories, because again, the stories are what we feel and what we connect to and how that person continues to be in our life.
Mm-hmm. That lifelong peace.
Yes.
Yeah, I want to bring up one other thing we haven't talked about. Why is it so hard besides the big emotions? When we study aspects of grief, there are two that come up a lot. One is ambiguous loss and one is disenfranchised loss. And that's what we do a lot. We don't allow anybody to have a full-bodied process. You can cry, but you can't cry in 4 months. You know, you can cry, but you can't throw up. I mean, really, we truncate it. And so disenfranchised loss is it's the people. So we disenfranchise, like, we don't want to hear about suicide. It's stigmatized. We don't want to hear about that. You're disenfranchised. No, we found this with lots of different communities. Pet loss, it's just a dog. So look at all we have to. If you're willing to look at grief with a friendly eye and a curious eye, you can start to see all the ways that we internally and culturally just shut down grief because we don't want it to be too much. We don't want it to be too long. Sometimes it's really gross. Like, part of the reason that we have so much trouble is that the corporate structure in America doesn't want to pay for enough bereavement leave for people. So people partly think that grief should be over with quickly because they're given 3 days at work.
Yeah, they're supposed to get back to work and be part of the workforce. And that's societally acceptable. So I just want to say that makes a lot of sense. When we look at bereavement leave, I think that is a way that we're seeing what society, what we hold in value. Mm-hmm. So we're saying, hey, you work for, that happened for a previous hospice I worked for. They tried to truncate the amount of time that one got for bereavement leave. If a nonprofit hospice is doing that, then think about what is happening in corporate America. Mm-hmm. And we also know that the longer time, I'm sure there is a study out there with that, we can't exaggerate this, but the idea that the longer time that we actually have to be able to go in, do ritual, be with family, start the grief process, right? Again, this is just the beginning, that we can actually come back and have a little bit more energy, be a little more clear in thought, be able to get our tasks done. So I think in a lot of ways, we are complicating things on both ends of that. Mm-hmm. But yes.
Yeah, so that's why people... table bangers like us are important, because there is, unless you have someone saying, yes, it's normal. Oh, you're a month out. Of course it's supposed to be worse for you right now because you're no longer in shock and you're starting to live with this horrible reality. You know, and again, we see that, well, people can, amazing things can happen. And again, I'm not going to say everybody transforms, but things like Mothers Against Drunk Drivers, you know, we look back and I was looking yesterday at all the women who have created things out of their grief. Mothers Against Drunk Drivers is a really important one. But if you look back in history, some people live with grief well and they do something. Harriet Tubman. Other people collapse into it. And that's what we're trying to avoid is that, again, naming it and just saying, we're out here, we're all dealing with this. Sometimes that's just enough for people to be freed up. It resonates with them. The truth resonates with us. We just need somebody to name it and somebody to stand behind it. And I think that is a lot that is changing as the boomers get older because we are incredibly selfish and we want things our way. And so we are shifting what's okay to talk about with death and dying. I think one of the things, honestly, that gets in our way is the aging process because we were pretty invincible. So when we talk about that grief of aging, I can't tell you how many people go, ah, oh, yeah, that's okay. It doesn't mean I'm weak. Ah, oh, yeah, that's okay.
I'm going to actually circle back to something that Kim started with a couple of minutes ago in this part of our conversation around pet loss, around suicide loss. And that, again, what we're doing here on these airwaves is educating the community, having them hear the stories here, letting them hear themselves. And so we can come from a time that says that if suicide, if somebody completed suicide, that's bad. And I could go through implications there. But actually, aren't that those family members or the people that love that person, they probably need the most support of anybody because we're talking about a traumatic loss, a sudden loss, all of these things that, as we've been talking about, can bring up all these feelings in our bodies. They bring up our feelings around our spiritual life. They bring up all these things. So I just want to say, yes, we're here to support all people that we're talking about, but really let's start looking at where have we not shown a light. Mm-hmm. And I think having shining a light in these places are really important, especially as we're having these larger discussions.
I know one other thing I want to make sure we cover, because you mentioned this a couple of times, you're very somatically based, is how this shows up in the body. And this goes back to what you said, what really happens. Our bodies have held grief for as long as we've been human. And if you think about it, you'll hear people say, I feel it in my gut. You know, I knew it. There's lots of expressions around in our bodies, what it is that, I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. So this is what holds it. So we are more likely to experience illness. A lot of people have actually talked about feeling like they got cancer because they couldn't let go of. And so that piece of relating to your body becomes really important. And what we would say to people is, even if you can't understand what's going on in your head, all this stuff is being broken up or however you want to frame it inside. So just treat the body well and let it go on. We used to say 5 things. Try to eat. Eat well if you can. Try to remember to drink liquids because it flushes toxins out of the body, and we get dehydrated when we cry. And so liquids are really important. And in other cultures, liquids are considered important magic components of grief. Like I worked with a teacher from Burkina Faso who said that they wear blue bracelets, that they use water to move grief through the body. So there's an integral relationship with our bodies. So we say to people, no matter if you can get out of bed, no matter how bad it is, try to eat okay. Try to drink liquids, hopefully not alcohol, because we tend to fall into whatever coping mechanisms we had before. Try to get some sleep. Is it normal not to sleep? Yeah, it is. But at a certain point, it's going to get in the way of you being able to function. Try to get a little exercise. And then the fifth one is community. Like we said, that is going to, people who are totally isolated, we see this in baby animals who lose their mothers, totally isolated, they don't thrive, and they can get really sick from not being in community. So even if you don't know what's going on, if you can manage those 5 very basic things so your body can take care of it while you're under or you're gone, you're probably going to do okay. Studies have proven that most people will come out of grief on their own if they have support. Coming out of doesn't mean that it's over. It just means that you're no longer incapacitated by it.
I think it's also just going back to a more current events thing. We had, I'm just going back to the past couple of weeks. I mean, we've had some swatting scares, for example. And so it's not, you know, I'm looking for, as a news director, looking for the right words for it. So I don't use the word hoax or prank because it's not funny at all. Mm-hmm. And we had some students in from Boulder High. It was the week after the first swatting incident, and it was the day they were here when their phones went off, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and in some cases, that was really the first time that they talked about it in a group. I'm wondering, like, what kind of supports are needed for, you know, you have teachers who have, you know, you have like an experience that is a very real reason to fear for your
mm-hmm,
death
mm-hmm.
at work. Mm-hmm. And then the next day you're told to just go back to work mm-hmm. and like teach in front of a group. What kind of tools are available or should be made available mm-hmm. for teachers who have those experiences of, you know, thinking they might die mm-hmm. at their job one day mm-hmm. and then, you know, just showing up to work like nothing the next day?
You know, this is an important distinction between grief and trauma. So there's normal grief, which is your reaction after any kind of a loss that you perceive. And trauma is different. Trauma can get really stuck in your body. So when we say when people grieve normally, what that means is that their assumptive world goes away. So the grief, part of the grief in that is, oh my God, this could never happen to me. I don't believe it. There's a point of shock. This can't happen to me. But trauma, where you're afraid for your life, it doesn't just process by itself. You're always waiting for another shoe to drop. So we talk about trauma in two words, helplessness and horror. You know, I can't do anything about this. What happens tomorrow? And the processing around that, again, as Thad would say, is very individual, depending what your history is, what you carried into that room. Some of those kids who may have been exposed to something like this before, they're going to need a whole different process. But in general, again, talk about it. Normalize it together. Find out what other people are thinking, because all they have to do is tell you their reactions and you know you're not weird. And then concretely put in place what you know you can. We tell kids, people, don't ever tell your kids, don't worry, I'll never die, because that's not true. But to say I'll do everything possible to make sure that you're safe and that I won't die. So in trauma situations, that's why they do some form of debriefing. Does everybody even know all of what happened? Let's get you in a room. You have to do it skillfully and make sure that the people know that you are doing the best you can to make sure it doesn't happen again and that you're normal, and support that personal piece and as well as the safety piece.
I thank you for asking these questions and talk about a tough question that's right here with us. So again, Kim spoke to it more globally. I'll speak to it from my lens as a private practitioner. That's why I like using a modality called brain spotting. There's also EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, somatic experiencing. There's a lot of different avenues to be able to access what's held in the body, what's held in the limb. Limbic brain, again, where that amygdala, fight, flight, or freeze response is. And so that's when we think about flashbacks, when we think about all the senses, sight, smell, sounds that are similar, and we don't even have to know that they're actually happening. This is subcortically, this can be happening underneath the surface that we walked to school and we haven't thought about it for quite a while, but the same, the way that the sun is coming through the clouds that day, the grass being mowed that day in this way, those things can set off our nervous system to say, oh no, this is similar to what that was. Mm-hmm. And these other modalities that we can do on an individual basis, and they can be done in groups as well, is a way to allow the brain to understand that that was traumatizing, but currently in this moment, you are not going through that trauma. Mm-hmm. So again, there are different avenues from which to work from, but that would be one of them.
Mm-hmm. We are in our final minute. I want to let you both wrap up with any kind of final thoughts that you'd like to share before we have to go.
Well, I guess overview, I mean, I'm glad we've been able to say this much, but it's really important to realize that everybody brings all of their history and all of their processing and all of their support and all of their trauma into every moment. So it's really critical to treat each person individually and help them understand that, that find ways to support them through that. This is one of the most important topics in our lives. And I guess that would be my wrap up.
Cool. I'll just say that I thank you, thank you, thank you, both of you who are in this room, those of you who are listening, and for allowing me to be a part of this conversation. I was born and raised in Boulder, and so to be able to speak to folks that are listening to us right now and be able to talk about this issue in particular, I just feel honored to be with y'all.
If you're interested in grief workshops and working with more of this, get on my mailing list. My website is practically-dying.com, and we'll be doing a lot more around this. And a lot of what I do is not about walking in and saying, Shannon, you're going to die. It really is about starting to find those more entertaining and engaging ways to talk about this. But this is it's an incredibly important topic.
Kim Mooney, grief counselor, thank you as always for your quarterly program. Your guest today has been Thad Fry, who also is a counselor. You are listening to KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver.